Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
It's Thursday, 1 o'clock, and you are tuned into the Farm Report, brought to you by the Heritage Radio Network. And I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. We're coming to you live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on a beautiful 50-plus degree day in the middle of February. A little crazy. And we are on the line with Sherry Shaver of Beaverkill Trout Hatchery. Sherry, welcome to the show.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Are you guys getting some of this lovely sunny weather up in the Catskills?
We are. We did have a nice little snowstorm early this morning that covered the ground, and then it cleared off, and it's sunshiny here, and it's about 40 degrees.
Oh, lovely. So we are kind of continuing a series of shows where we're talking to different producers from the Catskills region, and you know, your name and the Beaverkill Trout Hatchery has come up in a couple different conversations I've been having over the last few weeks. And I thought we'd start off the show by learning a little bit more about, you know, you and how you guys got started growing trout.
Okay, the Beaverkill Trout Hatchery was spawned in about 1963 by my great-grandfather, Fred D. Shaver. He had a vision, I guess, because we will be in business for 50 years next year.
Wow.
We have five generations of the family that's worked with trout since he started.
That's exciting. I mean, I don't know a ton about the history of fish farming, but I have to assume that in you know, the early 1960s, was that kind of a bold move on his part? I mean, how did the idea even occur to him? Do you know?
Well, he was actually the caretaker for a private trout fishing club on the Beaverkill River and took an interest in the trout. He was an avid fisherman and outdoorsman, hunter as well, and took an interest in monkeying around with hatching out trout. And I'm thinking that initially he had gotten eggs in from a hatchery in Pennsylvania and started hatching them out, although I believe he may have worked some with some wild brook trout, and built a small hatchery building on the fishing club's property up there with some ponds outside, and started from there. And it wasn't until probably the 70s that we actually moved the whole operation down in its entirety onto our 200-acre farm. Which was a former dairy farm right up until the late 60s, I believe. We've been out of the dairy farming business.
Wow, that's like, I feel like such a common story with people that you talk to who are doing kind of interesting stuff throughout New York State is it was once a dairy farm and is now transformed into some other type of agricultural production. So how about yourself? I mean, it sounds like you grew up in the trout hatching world, but was it obvious to you from the time you were a small child that you would stay on, or did you struggle with that decision?
No, actually, I always was around with my dad and my grandfather and great-grandfather, plus my whole family. I have two brothers and a sister. We were just, we were always going on fish deliveries when we were little, and that was, since we're 14 miles from any town here, so kind of had to entertain yourselves, whether it be going out in the fish ponds in your shorts and wading around or whatever. And actually, I went to school in Waverly, West Virginia for horse training and riding instructing, and came back from that. And my dad says, "You want to go to work for me?" And how could I say no?
The rest is history, as they say.
Yes.
So maybe you can kind of help paint a visual picture for our radio listeners of what exactly a fish farm looks like, and what type of scale you guys are talking about. I'm just a general sense of, you know, how one, if were to go about, if I were to move up to, you know, a 200-acre dairy farm, what would I kind of need to do to get started?
Water supply is the key to the whole operation. We are blessed with some marvelous springs on our property that are gravity feed. That, therefore, we don't have the overhead of electricity on that. We also have some wells and Alder Creek that actually runs right by our hatchery. So good water is the key to the whole thing. The overall, if you were to, trying to tell you about the hatchery down here, we have a building that is fed by spring and well water, and that's where all the hatching takes place. We just got done hatching out probably about, I would say there's 200,000 baby trout in there right now.
Wow.
There's 13 what I call vats that the water runs through that the little trout are all into. And that water from there then spills out into a concrete raceway, which is home to the brown trout that we hatched out last year at this time. And they're probably, well, 5 to 6 inches long. And below that, there's another set of 5 earthen ponds. And then there is another 12 earthen ponds beyond that on this side of the farm. And then if we go over on across the road onto the other side of the farm, we have a set of concrete ponds over there that is home to the brook trout we hatched out last year and the rainbows and golden rainbows. And there are 5 dirt ponds over there with all full of fish.
Wow. So maybe starting back at the beginning in the area where you're hatching out. So you are working, it sounds like, with a couple different types of trout. So you mentioned brook and rainbow.
Right.
And
we raise brook trout, brown trout, rainbow trout, and golden rainbow trout.
And can you tell me a little bit about what's the difference between the three?
Okay, the brook trout would have been native to this area, and you still can catch wild brook trout in some of these streams. They like really cold water. They're the ones that they had so much trouble up in the Adirondacks with the acid rain affecting those because they just can't stand any kind of pollution. Brown trout, I think, were imported from Europe back in probably the 50s or whatever, and they're the hardiest of all the trout. They'll take the warmer temperatures. They're the best for river stocking, lakes. They're just aggressive. They're very cannibalistic. They'll eat pretty much anything that gets in their way. They're very smart. Once you hook a brown trout, you're going to be a while before you hook it again. That's why they get so big, because they're so smart. And they tend to, like we stock a lot of the rivers around here, they tend to stay where they're put, even in high water, so that they're around for a few years after they're stocked. Rainbow trout are the fastest growers of the three trout. We can get an inch a month on those in good conditions. They are very tasty to eat. They are the friendliest fish. Like when we're feeding all the fish around here, they're the most lively, jumping out of the water, what have you. The golden rainbow trout are actually native to the Rocky Mountains, West Virginia, and they look like they're gold, like a goldfish, but they're a trout. They're beautiful. They grow very well too. The only problem with those is they're easier for the birds to pick out. We have quite a bald eagle population around here, and they really like to pick on our goldies.
Right. I guess they like shimmering from above, right?
Right.
So when you are in the hatching process, do you hatch out? You know, it's like different, the different types of fish all go in a certain cycle. So like all 200,000 that you just hatched out are all the same type of fish. And then you would move into, you know, go from brown to brook to rainbow. Or do you do them in kind of batches at the same time? I mean, how do you kind of manage working with the different types?
When the eggs come in, meaning when the females are ripe and they're ready to spawn, usually it's in stages. Like our brook trout will come in first, So we'll take those eggs first, and then we'll set aside a section of the hatchery with, like, say, six different vats for them. And then when the brown trout come in, we'll take those. And then when the rainbow trout come in, we'll take those. So it's all our with the egg, when the eggs come in, depends on what the weather conditions for the year have been. Like last year, we had so much rain that we were actually taking eggs here before Labor Day. Now, I've seen it in times that when we've had a drought that it wasn't till, let's say, the end of October when we were taking the eggs. So everything we do is controlled by nature here, pretty much.
Okay, so and when you guys are harvesting eggs from fish that are already on your, like, on the farm, essentially, you're not buying in eggs.
Right, we're taking all from our own brood stock.
And, you know, forgive me, I'm going to belie some ignorance here. Can you take the eggs without killing the fish? Or
yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yep, there's almost zero mortality when we're taking the eggs, unlike salmon. You've probably seen on TV where, well, even up on Lake Ontario, when they go to spawn, there's such a high mortality that there's just dead fish all over the place. That's not the case down here with our fish.
Okay, so you're able to harvest the eggs and then you hatch them out, and they are in the vats, which I'm assuming are something like an above-ground pool, basically?
A vat is like a trough.
Okay.
And they have screens in, you know, to keep the fish in the vat. And the water runs in the top, comes down through that vat, goes down a hole, and drops into another vat.
Okay.
And then goes out.
And how long are the fish kind of staying in this first area?
They will be in there until we can get more fish moved around from all the concrete raceways that we have fish in now. Will be transferred. Those fish will be transferred out. Then those raceways will be steam cleaned, disinfected, and then filled back up. And then we'll move the fish from the hatchery into their new clean home.
Okay. And while they're in the hatchery, how are you feeding them? What do the fish eat?
Well, it's like our fish food comes in graduated sizes. So right now, this stuff that they get is almost like a dust. Like, you just shake it. Like, be like similar to like pepper, I guess you could say, and just shake it on top of the water, and they come up and eat.
And then the water, I'm assuming there's a constant kind of inflow, outflow of the water.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I know one of the other issues with farm fishing that you hear a lot about is kind of the waste products of the fish and how that impacts the area where they're raised. And so how do you guys deal with that on the farm? And is it different for different stages?
Yes. Well, we, inside the building, we siphon a lot of it out of the bottoms, discard it outside into a pile. And then in our other ponds outside, we do a lot of pumping. We have a trash pump. And I still have horses down here on the farm, so we try to fertilize the fields as much as we can, you know, because we use the hay, the grass, whatever, for the animals.
Right. So then you can kind of work with something of a closed system. You're not at a point now where you're like, I mean, is it something that you could sell, essentially? Like, they sell manure?
Sure we could. Yes, we could. That's another avenue to pursue one day. When we get busy down there, we have just all we can do to hang on and keep going.
Yeah, I'll bet. So the fish go from the hatchery into the concrete raceways, and they're in that area. And what's kind of happening while they're in there? I mean, why not go right out into the pond?
Because they're too small, they're too fragile, and they're more susceptible to pick up viruses and different things. Plus, we have such a prey population with birds and everything else that they're actually covered with, we have netting that goes over top of the concrete raceways. And on some parts of the farm, we even have to have electric fence around to keep the bears out. We've got everything it likes trout.
Everyone loves a fish dinner, huh?
Yeah, everybody's at our house here.
So they go from the raceways out into the ponds, and it sounds like there's a couple different kinds. You said an earthen, a concrete, and then is a dirt pond separate from an earthen pond, or?
It's the same thing.
Okay.
Yep, and all these ponds, all through the generations, have been built by the family. This was all laid out by, you know, my father, grandfather, and great-grandfather.
And well, I mean, as far as, aside from just kind of digging a big hole in the ground, I mean, what does it essentially take as far as maintaining a man-made pond?
Water supply. We have screens. There's like, the water goes from one pond and drops to another pond. So you need to have a certain slope, you know, because you need a pitch going from pond to pond.
Okay, so that the water will move without, you know, you're not carrying buckets from one pond to the next.
Right, so that it moves naturally, plus we get the natural aeration as it goes from pond to pond. Therefore, we don't have to have an overhead of oxygen and all that stuff like a lot of other hatcheries do.
Awesome. Well, I want to tuck into a little bit more about how you guys kind of keep those ponds healthy and that water good for growing the fish, but we're going to take a short break and then get into that when we come back.
Okay.
Sponsored by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Summertime is not the only time when barbecue is welcome. At S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, Sam Edwards has been working his magic on ribs, briskets, pit-cooked pulled pork, and much, much more. Add a few of their sides and the party is complete. Entertaining has never been so easy. To order, go to virginiatraditions.com.
All right, we're back. You're listening to the Farm Report, and we are on the line with Sherry Shaver of Beaverkill Trout Hatchery. So, Sherry, you've mentioned this a couple times throughout the show, the importance of water to your fish farming operation. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit, you know, you guys are located up in the Catskills, and how, you know, essentially that region shapes what you're able to do.
Well, we're thankfully quite protected. As far as any pollution, development, what have you going on where we are here, somehow that happened. The biggest problem we have a state-owned lake above us, and unfortunately that's not managed quite the way it should, and it seems to get a lot of traffic in the summertime up there with one port-a-john and 100 people. It just doesn't seem like a workable situation to me. That would be our biggest problem that I can foresee as far as water quality would go here.
And the water that you guys are that you guys are getting onto the farm, you said, is from the well, and then obviously from the Beaverkill River.
We don't take any water from the Beaverkill. The Beaverkill runs sort of parallel to our operation.
Okay.
We're on a tributary of Alder Creek.
Okay.
And so that doesn't impact us. What did impact us a lot last year is we had such high water pretty much all summer long. And when we had the Hurricane Irene in the fall there, wow, it was the highest water I've seen since about 1969 here.
Oh, wow. And so the high water is a problem because...
Because we need to keep all of this in between each pond. There's screens that go from pond to pond, And when you get a lot of rain, wind, whatever, they plug up from leaves and just water turbulence. So we have to keep all the screens raked down. But the creek itself was spilling over its banks, as was the Beaverkill River, which was getting dangerously close as it flooded up to our property line. And also the water pressure backs the creek that we're on up. The water has nowhere to go coming out of Alder Creek, so you get a back pressure of water because it's just so much water and has nowhere to go that it was pushing up into our lower pond system. Thank gosh things that stopped when it did.
Yeah, that must have been a little harrowing. I mean, essentially, there's probably, I mean, is there much you can do other than, like, cross your fingers and hope it doesn't get any higher?
You pray a lot.
Well, I'm glad that it, you know, was maybe just, like, a little bit of excitement, but nothing long-term or lasting as far as damage.
Compared to what happened in other areas in New York State, we certainly got off easy, really.
Good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I want to talk a little bit about maintaining pond health. So you had mentioned that, you know, because of the way that you have your system set up, you guys don't have to worry about putting in oxygen. Or can you talk a little bit about, you know, in regards just generally growing fish, like what are some of the inputs that people use and what do you guys do and how is that maybe different from other farms?
Well, as far as when we do have an oxygen problem, which we very well could, I'm foreseeing a drought this summer because we've had not hardly any snow. We'll not get the melt off or anything come springtime around there unless a lot of things change before then. We put in aerators, artificial aeration if need be. We try to pump more water from different sources on the farm. And if we have to, in extreme cases, we can put in oxygen diffusers and run oxygen. But that's just a temporary situation.
Because what is it that fish need in order to kind of grow?
Oxygen.
Oxygen, and then feed, right? Essentially.
Yep. Oxygen, feed, and water temperatures no higher than 67. That's pushing it right there.
Yeah.
Trout can't take warm water.
And you said it's different amongst the different types of trout. Some of them, which was it that likes it a little cooler?
The brook trout. That's why we keep them on one side of the farm that's fed by all spring and well water, where the other side of the farm, we use springs, well, and we take in some water from the creek.
Okay. Maybe you could kind of take us through, you know, what would be a typical day for you on the farm? Like, what are your, essentially, like, the chores and the stuff that you have to go through to keep things running?
Well, on a daily basis, the main order of business is to get down there in the morning, make sure the water is running through the whole operation. Right now, inside the hatchery building with all the babies in there, making sure that the valves don't get plugged up with any silt or sediment coming off from the springs. And just cleaning screens, just checking everything, and then feeding everything. It takes about probably 2 hours a day to do that right now. But the end of March, we'll jump into high gear here and start preparing orders to be shipped out to Connecticut, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, all over the state. The preparation for opening day of trout season here in New York is April 1st.
Okay. So
then I will have a crew of probably 3 to 4 guys, 2 drivers, just driving truck, delivering, live haul, that is, live delivering.
Wow.
To different areas of streams, ponds. We do a lot of trout fishing derbies. It's everybody's got to have their fish in before the first.
Okay, so that's kind of crunch time on the farm. I just want to back up for a quick second. How long does it take the trout from the time they're hatched out to the time they're kind of ready to go into market?
Rainbow trout would be the fastest growers. We could get them, if we have ideal conditions, to 12 inches in a year, maybe even bigger. You're looking at a good year on all of them to get them to a marketable size. we don't sell anything under 6 inches long. So within a year, we would have them up to 6 inches, some bigger, some smaller.
Okay. And now you, so it sounds like you guys are selling to other stream. I guess I'm a little unclear where you're selling fish into and kind of how that works. So it doesn't sound like you're just, you know, down at a farmer's market or selling into a shop, but you're also selling live fish to stock other streams and ponds and areas kind of in the region. Is that right?
Right. Most of our business is live haul, live delivery to private fishing clubs, which there's a very large population of those on the whole Beaverkill River and most of your rivers around New York State, private lakes. So we deal all privately. And just the average Joe that's got a backyard pond, a lot of people buy trout, put them in their pond, feed them, and then they will catch them out at their leisure and to eat.
Yeah, no, my grandpa does that. It's always a treat to go back home to Michigan and have him whip up some trout from the pond. So I'm just curious, in these areas, you know, these private streams or ponds that you're stocking, I mean, is there a reason that the trout don't kind of self-propagate? I mean, do they need some other type of management to survive in the wild, or is it just like the volume at which they'd be able to replace themselves is not in line with kind of how quickly they're being taken out, or why is there kind of a need?
The natural predators, blue herons, ospreys, eagles, bears, raccoons. A lot of these private fishing clubs, the members pay a lot of money to belong to these clubs. And, of course, people want to catch fish. That's the idea of the whole thing.
Right.
You know, and it's a great sport.
Sure. Growing up on Lake Huron, there was always a lot of, salmon fishing that happened kind of in my backyard. And you know, size was always kind of the bragging right. You know, whoever can catch kind of the biggest fish was the best fisherman. How is that? Is that similar for trout? I mean, and if so, like, how big can they get? Or what's like a trophy trout kind of look like?
Trophy trout. It depends on who's telling the story, I guess. Anything over 16 inches probably would be considered a trophy. We have trout down here on the farm that are probably 25, 26 inches long.
Wow. And now are you still eating trout? Is it something that still makes its way to your dinner table?
Not mine, no.
No?
No, I also do. I have my own little smoking business as well, and I smoke trout kind of on the off of. The trout stocking season runs hot and heavy from the end of March, let's say, to the end of June.
Okay.
We pretty much have, unless, you know, it's an ideal summer where it's cool and we have a lot of rain, then we can continue stocking. But then the restaurant farmers market business picks up. Usually right after Memorial Day, things start to come back to life around here as far as the restaurants go.
Okay.
So we'll be delivering fish to restaurants, and I also do two farmers markets here, one in Margaretsville at the Packatackin and one in Calicoon on Sundays, selling fresh trout and smoked trout.
And smoked trout. So then do you guys have a fish processing, I mean, on site, I'm assuming? How do you just gut them, or do they go in whole? I mean, how does one, like, you know, kill a fish on a fish farm and then make its way to market, like from the pond to the market, essentially?
We pretty much throw them in a cooler of ice, take them for a little ride around the farm, come back and clean them.
Okay.
And that's, then they would be on their way, and they're dressed and put on ice. Everything is ice, you know.
Yeah,
quality.
Transitioning the water into yet another form.
Right.
So if someone wanted to purchase some of your trout, how can they get in touch with you?
Oh, they can call the farm. Do you want that phone number?
Yeah, sure.
It would be 845 239-4947. We also have a fish for fee or fishing preserve on the farm down here. That's where people can come, and they do not need a fishing license to fish there. Just bring your own pole, your own bait. The pond's open Saturdays and Sundays from 8 to 5, and we have one large pond that they can fish in. We also have a roadside stand there where we sell the smoked trout and fresh trout. If somebody was not successful at catching, we certainly will make sure they have fish to take home with them.
And what kind of bait is it for trout?
Worms and bobbers work the best, especially when you're if you're bringing children. The less hooks, the better.
Yeah.
spinners are effective.
Brings me back to some other childhood memories that were less pleasant. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for being on the show today. It was great to get a chance to talk with you, and we'd love to have you on again, maybe later in the season, to talk about how things turned out for you and what the weather ended up doing this year.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back on the line with the lovely ladies of Good Food Jobs. So stay tuned. We're bringing it back, and we are on the line with Taylor Kokalis of Good Food Jobs. Taylor, how are you? Oh, good. Your line is a little spotty. I'm not sure if maybe you can try and move to another spot. We'll give it a chance to clear up.
You let me know if you can hear me. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's coming through a little better. So we just want to do a quick shout-out. You guys are launching your very first Good Food Jobs Fair in collaboration with Just Foods tomorrow. So I was wondering if you could give us some of the highlights that people can look forward to.
Yes.
Ooh, I don't... It's still pretty scratchy. I'm sorry. We will pursue in our quest for a good food job once we get a good line connection, I guess.
Aaron?
Yeah.
Aaron? Oh. Okay, sorry about that. I literally just ran right into the middle of the street. Hopefully this will be better.
Well, talk quickly.
Good Food Jobs Fair is happening in conjunction with Just Food Conference tomorrow. So we'll be having 46 awesome hand-picked food-related businesses and organizations that'll be tabling, telling everyone about the opportunities that they have available, both currently and in the future, and sort of cultivating respect and appreciation for all the good work that everyone's doing, and really putting a face-to-face interaction with what usually happens online on GoToJobs.com. So we're super psyched about it.
That's exciting. So, can people still join the job fair? Are tickets available yet? Or
unfortunately, it's completely sold out and has been for a week. So we've
had
a lot.
Wow! Congratulations.
Yeah, it's great. We're also really saddened because there are dozens of folks who have reached out desperate for tickets. But I've been telling everyone, some enterprising job seeker has got to start a like a meetup at a bar near the conference and call it the Good Food Jobs Unfair and protest that there weren't more tickets available and get a little networking going on themselves.
Well, in the meantime, they can definitely pass some time perusing your website. Can you just give us a quick overview of what's available through the website that people are going to have access to kind of all the time if they can't make it to the job fair?
Surely. So you can always check out goodfoodjobs.com. Right now we're averaging a little over 500 active jobs on the site at any given time. Anything from different opportunities in agriculture, nonprofit, media, culinary. So really quite a broad spectrum of opportunities available and growing by the day. In a little over a year and a half, we've posted over 3,200 jobs. So there's lots of good stuff to come. Also, should anyone be really disappointed about missing out on the fair, please reach out early and often. You can reach us through the site or just email me directly, taylor@goodfoodjobs.com. I'm always happy to have phone chats or informational interviews or help people in whatever way we possibly can. We're also, you know, having a Good Food Jobs table at the fair and creating a whole bunch of guides for people on how to find meaningful food work, how to conduct an informational interview, and things of this nature, so that we'll have them at the ready. So if anyone reaches out to us by email, we'll send those PDFs to them.
Awesome. Well, Taylor, thanks so much for joining us to do a quick shout out. Good luck tomorrow up at the Food and Finance High School, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Erin. Hope to see you while we're in town.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So tune in next week on the Farm Report. We'll have Assemblyman Hakeem Jeffries and Anthony Butler of Bread and Life. So it should be a great show. See you next week, 1 o'clock Thursday on the Farm Report.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.